I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and then we'll answer any questions from the audience if there's time. Let's all welcome Jerry. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Jerry Seeger. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for the privilege of being able to come and speak with you this morning. I look around and about 12 of my friends came with me, and four of whom my sponsor, and one who is my sponsor. So what an incredible group to, you know, you're never alone, and you're just surrounded by quality people. Among the guys that were with us today, one is a man who took 30 days today, and another one who took 29 years yesterday. So we have the bookends and everything in between. I bought this book 10,384 days ago. It was only $3 then. I think they've gone up since then. And when I got to my first AA meeting, I was drunk. I had left the house. And the last thing I did was, I knew there was a bottle of Bailey's up on the top shelf, and I took a big swig of that chocolate milk and went to my first meeting. And so that's how I got here, but there was a lot going on before then. I told you I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic with an Irish Catholic enhancement. And my parents were first generation born in this country. My mom was Irish, my father was German. And back, that was in New York City. And back then, the focal point of their lives was the church. You'd go to the church, you'd go to the pastor to find out where you could get an apartment, where you could get a job. We had some fun with this, you know, to get a job where they would hire an Irish person, which was very difficult. And the priest would, you know, set you up at that. They find you a place to live. They'd say, you know, this is maybe somebody you should look at to marry. And it was literally the focal point of their life. So as happens back then, it happened to be St. Jerome's Parish. And my first name is Jerome, and I never particularly cared for that name. Still don't particularly care for it, but that's the way it was. And I see that as one of the reasons I never fit in, because nobody has a name like Jerome. You know, I'll tell you, I went to Avis one time in Oakland, California at the airport, and I'm renting a car, and the woman said, Jerome, we need to see some ID, honey. So, okay. You know, and I thought that was terrible, but my brother was born when the family had moved to St. Mary's Parish. So he had a much tougher time of it than I did. In my family, drinking was always part of everyday life. And I wouldn't say that my parents got crazy, sloppy drunk ever, but it was just always going on. It was, you know, when somebody would come to the house, it was always get their coat and get them a drink. That was the first thing that they'd say. And so it was just a very natural thing. And I remember that you know, people say, when did you have your first drink? And I can think back to probably 8 or 10 years old when I recognized that, you know, I'm drinking something that makes me feel different, but it was no big deal. I kind of like the taste of the wine that they had, sweet wine. And the relatives liked it when I'd made the drinks because I usually poured them pretty good. You know, as a 10-year-old, I was pretty good at it. So but it wasn't until, you know, I started to tell you, I never fit in. I was, you know, a red-haired, freckle-faced kid. I was always the smallest one in my class. I had a goofy first name. And, you know, I just never fit in anywhere. And there were four in my family, four cousins across the street. And we were matched in age and sex. So we had our own party of eight cousins wherever we went, and we didn't really need anybody else. And as I think about it, I didn't have any friends when I was growing up. I didn't need any because we had our cousins that we were kind of raised as brothers and sisters. So I didn't have a lot of interaction with other people, and it was just easy to kind of be reclusive. When I was in high school, in New York, you could drink when you were 18. So when I was a senior in high school, still very afraid to go up and approach a girl or to be, part of a group. And then somebody said, "Hey, we're going out drinking tonight. You want to go with us?" I said, "Heck yeah!" So that was the first time that I kind of sort of felt that I would fit in, and it worked. You know, not that I probably only had a beer or two, but I was in with a group of guys that it was fun to be with, and it was nice to be able to say, "Hey, I went drinking with Bobby Bohack last night. What do you think about that?" You know, and it was fun. And alcohol worked for me for a long time. It was great. You know, it let you go up and approach a pretty girl. It let you, learn how to dance. It let you, even if you didn't, it let you be funny. It let you be taller. My freckles faded. You know, I didn't worry about my red hair. And for the first time, you're part of a group. And my cousin had gone away to college. And when he came back, for the first time, it was around Christmas time, for the first time, he went over to the fridge at home and grabbed a beer. And we'd never done that before. You know, we'd never had a beer. And I figured, well, it must be okay. So that's when I got started having a beer here and there at home. And it was really working. I remember I went to join a fraternity, and the next day, the guy says to me, "Boy, you came to join a fraternity. Maybe you should join AA instead," because I got absolutely hammered. And little did I know that that would have been the case. And as I think about my past, there were plenty of times when I absolutely hit bottom and bounced off and kept doing that. And the bottoms got a little deeper, and maybe you come back up surface for a while longer and just kind of level things out, and things are going okay. When I really got into drinking, I remember one time I had traveled across the country with my uncle, who took my brother and I across the country, and he was pretty well off and had no children, so he took us when we were, I think I was 10 or 12, and my brother was 10. But he was a traveling salesman, and he had a bottle of Canadian Club in a red velvet bag, and he'd have it, in the hotel room. And then every night he would take like two shots of Canadian Club, and he always marked the label to see if the maid would have drunk any when he was out of the room. So I thought, well, this is how you do this. You know, this is just a normal part of everyday life. So, I was. That was just kind of ingrained. I can still remember him doing that. But then, I went out and got a job, and my first job, in college, I was the manager of a liquor store. What a perfect arrangement. So I could always have alcohol for fraternity parties and things like that. It was just great. You could always grab those little bottles and have a couple of those here and there, and nobody would ever know. When did I start wrecking cars? People now flip houses. I flip Volkswagens, and I flipped a lot of them. I remember one time a friend of mine and I were in a road rally, and you always need a case of beer and a bottle of Jack Daniels to be in a road rally, I thought. And this was the craziest thing. Back then, I did all my drinking before drunk driving became unpopular. Uh, and And the police would I remember one time, I must have been stopped a dozen times, driving drunk, and the cops would say, "What are you trying to kill yourself? Are you trying to kill your friends? Why are you on the highway going that fast? Take side streets, would you? Get off the parkway, you know." So, and that was the way it was. You know, one time I had a four-place Thunderbird, and this cop says, "Do you know how many people you've got in this car?" I said, "Wow, a lot." He says, "Yeah." He says, "I count seven in a four-place car." So, you know, what are you trying to kill your friends? Are you nuts? So, you think, wow, this is, but I'm bulletproof. You know, this, and the worst they would do would be tell you that, you know, where do you go to school? Well, Sacred Heart. Well, I'm going to take you to see Father Finian if I catch you doing this again. He said, "Oh man, you don't want to do that. You'd rather go to the cops than Father Finian, because he'd beat the crap out of you." So anyway, I was in this road rally, and we had come around a corner, and I flipped the car, and my friend and I went out the windshield. And I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, I didn't have any idea where he was. But the windshield had popped out of the car, and I guess, on the ground, but I got up in short order. And it turns out my car was spinning on the door, the driver's door, with the four wheels facing that way, and hit a police car. So... And I didn't get a ticket for that, you know. It was just incredible that I didn't get a ticket. And at the time, I'm looking around and pulling glass out of my butt, literally. And I said, "Well, that's handy. There's a bar right there. Once we get the paperwork done, we can go over there," you know. And that was really what I was thinking. So I said to my friend Kevin, I said, "You know, let's go over and get a drink when this is over." He said, "Are you crazy?" And I guess I was crazy. I guess I was. So, you know, it's funny. Mike asked me to speak today, and coincidentally, it would have been my dad's 95th birthday today. And, you know, I said that, you know, he probably was an alcoholic, but I'm not going to make that call. But I used to go to a meeting in Hermosa Beach on Sunday nights, and I took Dad to the meeting one time, and I said, "Well, what do you think, you know, after the meeting, what do you think?" And he said, "You know, everybody was very well behaved and they were very nicely dressed." I said, "Well, glad you got that out of it, you know, good for you, that we got an A for behavior and plays well with others." So along the way, I did a lot of geographics. I mean, a ton of them. And if you go and interview local taverns before you turn on your utilities, you might be an alcoholic. If you look out the front window and your car is in the driveway, thank God, you might be an alcoholic. If there's no front tire on the car, but you made it home on the rim, you might be an alcoholic. If you lose 13 jobs in 10 years, you might be an alcoholic. These are good jobs, by the way. If you do 6 major geographics in 6 years, you're probably an alcoholic. If you've wrecked at least 5 cars, but you don't know for sure how many, you might be an alcoholic. If you wake up out of a blackout on Easter Sunday morning and you're driving with your family on the 405 somewhere, but you don't know where, because you were off drinking all during Lent, and so you celebrated on Easter morning, had no idea where we were going, and it was very uncomfortable the third time I had to ask my wife where we were, what exit we were getting off at, because I had no idea where we were headed. That was a tough one. Let's see. I lost a lot of good jobs, and finally, met up with a company. You know, I could always go home and tell my wife, well, that company sucked. It didn't work out. You know, those people were a bunch of asses. And I was convinced that those companies would be out of business having let me go. And Xerox apparently thrived. Litton Industries did okay. Royal Typewriter Company did okay. Nabisco still around. They're doing okay without me. It surprised the crap out of me, but they're doing all right. Then I got with a company. This was the absolute most incredible dream job. I was selling cans for motor oil. That's how long ago this was. Cans for motor oil and frozen juice and things like that. I worked for the manufacturer. And I got the job having been fired from Xerox. I always had an easy time getting jobs. It was just that, you know, a week at most, I'd have a good job. Well, I got hired by Container Corporation of America. I was selling cans. And the first day there, I trying to get to the feel of what the job assignment's going to be, and I went to lunch with the man who hired me and his boss. I'm in my brand new company car. We're driving to lunch, and I said, "Well, now what's the quota? What am I expected to sell?" He said, "Well, you know, this is mostly a PR job. We're on long-term contracts with oil companies or with juice companies. Your job's going to be to take people around, show them a good time. We're going to get you tickets for the Angels, season tickets." This was in 1979. You're going to have a $2,500 a month expense account just for entertainment, and we hope that you spend it all so we get that much next year. And I actually was counseled one time because I wasn't spending enough on my entertainment. So we go to lunch, and I pick up the menu, and he says, "Well, my boy," he says, "we don't look at the menu until we've had our third drink." I said, "This is incredible. What an incredible company this is going to be. Holy crap." You know, and we'd go downtown to the Arco Tower and take the guys from Arco to lunch. My two bosses would be passed out on the seat as we're driving back to La Palma, to the office. It couldn't be better than this. Well, it turns out I outdrank them. I really did outdrink them. And I couldn't fill out my expense reports. It was money they owed me, and I'm sweating it out every month. I don't have enough money. But I wouldn't do my expense reports on a timely basis. And then when I finally did do them, nothing matched up in terms of where I was supposed to be and who I claimed was on the report. It was just a big paperwork snafu. I got let go. Went to work for another company. A friend of mine said, "There's a company over here that they sell plastic bottles. I'm buying antifreeze bottles from them. They seem like a pretty good outfit. You ought to give them a call." So I gave this guy a call, and he said, "Geez, you know, we do need some people pretty quick." So I started talking to him on a Monday. We met on Tuesday, and we met at a bar in Torrance. I started interviewing with him at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I left him about 11 at night. And I had secured my position with that company. Had to go in and do a little paperwork and interview with some other folks the next day or two. But by the following Monday, I was employed by them. And interestingly enough, people that I had visited with, the buyer from Pennzoil was there at one company, one Monday. The following Monday, he meets me at this other company. He says, "I'm not even going to ask any questions." So that's how we got started there. I'd been there for 7 weeks, and they took my wife and I on a trip to Tahiti with the rest of the management group. And that was to be the start of my relationship with this company. Things were going great. It was just incredible. And I had a good network of customers by then. Took us to Tahiti twice, and then I was kind of unpredictable in what I was selling and whatnot. I'd never seen a closed door in that company, and the first time I did see one, I was on the inside with the boss. I just brought in a very nice piece of business, so I said, "Oh, you must want to congratulate me on this piece of business that I brought in." So John comes in, and John says, "Come in and close the door." And it wasn't any question about, "Are you an alcoholic or anything like that?" He said, "You're an alcoholic, I'll do anything it takes to get you help, but if you don't get help, you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your family. You decide how you're going to do it. If you want to go to hospital, that's fine. If you want to go to AA, you might start there because that's usually where they wind up sending you anyway. A week later, I took that to heart. I went out and bought a six-pack and drove home. A week later, we're going to lunch, and we're walking to lunch, and he says, Jerry, isn't AA a marvelous organization? I see a change in you already. The change was I wasn't drinking at work. I wasn't drinking with customers. The change that he saw was just me really watching what I was doing. He said, isn't it a marvelous organization? I said, John, it certainly is. I'm thinking, holy crap, there must be a secret handshake or a password I'm supposed to know in order to get this. So I got out of his sight as quick as I could after lunch and had another six-pack on my way home. I worked in La Palma and lived in Manhattan Beach. I could have my first beer done by the time I made the Cloverleaf entrance onto the freeway. While I was on the Cloverleaf, that first beer would be done. Get home to Manhattan Beach, probably finish most of the six-pack on the way, and I did go to a meeting that night. I went to a meeting so that I could keep my job and continue to drink. That was the only reason I got to AA, the only reason. I was in that meeting and got there late, got there drunk, and I wasn't very, cordially accepted. They said, sit down and shut up. So I did, and after the meeting, this guy came up to me, and he said, he put his hand out, and he said, my name is Dale, and he said, you look pretty rough. What's going on? I said, oh, not much. I just wanted to check this out. He said, okay. I'll pick you up for a meeting tomorrow. I'm thinking, what? Tomorrow? Don't tell me you do this every day. So he's going to pick me up tomorrow for a meeting. And three times I tried to get out of it. I said, well, I'll meet you there. Where's the meeting? I'll pick you up. You don't understand. I still have a car. He said, yeah, I know. You've got a car and a watch. You're probably here too early. You might not get this. That's literally what they said. So I said, okay. I gave Dale my address, and the minute I gave him my address, I swear this was like a bolt out of the sky that hit me in the head. It was like a lightning bolt. It was an absolute spiritual awakening, and the obsession was absolutely lifted at that minute. I can honestly tell you that was it. I was done. Except, he said, I'm going to pick you up at 6:30 tomorrow. I said, what time's the meeting? I'm still in control, you see. He says, the meeting's at 8. I said, where the heck is it that you're picking me up at 6:30? He said, well, it's in Hermosa. I said, that's 5 minutes away. He said, yeah, we get there early and we stay late. So Dale picked me up every day for a month. And he was the guy who used to own the company, who's now working as a salesman for that company, just like in the book. Picked me up every night. About the third night, my wife and my three boys were at the end of the driveway, just little guys. And it's a picture I still see in my head of my wife, the hope that she had that this is going to work out. And my boys are just meeting one of my friends, But I left that night saying, I got to do this. I really got to do this. And Dale took me around every night for a month at least. Then I went to meetings there for a couple of years in a group where we traveled together regularly. Then I moved over to Placentia. One of the rewards of the program was I was able to buy my first house. And just through some good, smart business things going on, I was able to have a down payment finally put together. I was able to buy a house. I hear about people that are impatient. They said, I've done this, I've done that, I'm not getting the rewards. Some guy said, I'll never forget this, we're in a meeting and a guy gets up sharing and he says, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do, but I don't have a gold Cadillac yet and my wife hasn't lost 30 pounds. And I said, my car's in the parking lot and my wife's at home. I had both of those things. How crazy that is. So, came over here to Orange County and couldn't connect with a group. I was kind of bouncing off here and there, and I'd go to a meeting once in a while. Had no home group, just wasn't fitting in comfortably, but I was okay. I had plenty of time. But what happened, that wasn't working. So I worked with a guy who has become an incredibly close friend, and he made empty plastic bottles and I sold them. If you've ever had a gallon of milk in your hand, Mike made them and I sold them. I always sold them for less than he could make them for, which made me very successful. Anyway, Mike reached out for help, and I call it a reverse 12-step. It made me get back into action and to hook up with Mike, and basically I was saying, what meetings are you going to? What can we do together? It was a way to get moving together, and we've walked that path now for about 3 years. And it's just been an incredible journey. I mentioned that I'm here now with four of the men that I sponsor. And it's just an incredible opportunity to work with other people, to be of service to the program, to get out of yourself, and to have to maybe look in the book for the answers. They're all here in the owner's manual that'll tell us what to do. Rooms like this, it's just an incredible opportunity to be of service, to be of service to others. And no one here will get more out of this today than I will. I wish you could, but it's impossible. I don't see how anybody could get as much out of this as I have. It's just unbelievable. I feel that way usually when I lead a meeting. It's a blessing. It's a miracle that I'm here. And as you work the steps with other people, I just made a note here. Step five gets rid of that terrible isolation that tortured us because we didn't quite belong anywhere. Until we spoke with complete candor on a step five and listened to someone else do the same, you still don't belong. So there's a part of the step that's hidden in a little thing in this book that you read it 20 times, you don't ever see it, and then this pops out at you. Holy crap, I need to listen to somebody else to get this this done. At this phase of self, step five, you're going to have a spiritual awakening. You're going to actually feel the presence of God. And I'll finish by saying that you might be an alcoholic if you can't keep track of the miracles in your life. If you can't keep track of the miracles that you see in other people's lives, you might be an alcoholic. The last thing I want to tell you is people put opportunities in my life to do living amends, to amends from people from 30 years ago, people that are dead. I ask people for suggestions, how do you do that? And they tell me how to do that. I don't plan any wreckage of my future. It's just for today that I do this. And the last thing, I know my time is up, I can't believe it, but when it was a year ago and I was on a retreat, my sponsor Dale, who had carried me around for a month, he and I became, you know, we're still friends, we still talk once in a while, but I said, man, I'm sponsoring these guys, I need another sponsor. So we're at this retreat, and I decided already, you know, I'm going to ask Bruce right here if he'd be my sponsor. So Bruce and I and one of his people, one of his sponsees, were having coffee the morning of the retreat, and they start talking about this guy who had surgery on his knee, and he lived on Balboa, but he was recuperating in Rancho Mirage, and he'd had surgery in Sun Valley. So I'm thinking, wait a minute, that's Dale. So let me tell you how this worked. I was at a churchyard 27 years before in Manhattan Beach, and Dale, with his spiritual experience, became my sponsor. You know, I didn't ask him right then because I didn't know what sponsorship even was. After that, I asked him. I'm at this retreat with Bruce. We're talking about this guy, Dale. 27 years later, I've moved once, Dale's moved once, and Bruce has moved at least once. All these shenanigans going on, and there's a laser line from here to here, and I'm at a churchyard in Orange asking Bruce to be my sponsor. And that's just one of the small miracles in my life. You're the rest of the miracles. Don't leave before the miracles happen. And always ask for help from a higher power. Don't make it a laundry list or a Santa Claus list of things that you demand. I always say please before I say the Serenity Prayer, and I know that sets me apart from the rest of you, because I always get an answer. Thank you so much for letting me be here. It's just an incredible privilege. Thank you.